They said, of course, that it was indestructible. The safest, most luxurious ship that had ever been built. A sixth of a mile long it was, with a double bottom and 15 transverse bulkheads to protect its buoyancy. Even in enemy action, it would have taken 3 well-aimed torpedoes to have had any chance at all of sinking her. Yet, as those remarkable submarine television pictures reminded us this week, at midnight on Sunday, the 14th of April, 1912, nearing the end of her maiden voyage across the Atlantic, the Titanic struck an iceberg and sank, with the loss of 1,513 lives. One of the greatest maritime disasters of all time. The ironic thing, of course, is that it could so easily have been avoided. Several hours earlier, radio operators on board that liner had received warnings of dangerous icebergs in that area of the ocean. But such was the degree of euphoria on the bridge, those warnings were ignored, you see. And she continued steering full ahead at 22 knots through the darkness of the night. Even after the collision, there was no panic, for the sea was as calm as a mill pond, and the impact had scarcely been perceptible on the ship's massive frame. So the majority of those on board had no idea of the seriousness of the situation. Survivors recounted that some of the younger element among her wealthy passengers actually had a snowball fight with fragments of the deadly iceberg that had fallen on the deck. And the sinking of the Titanic represents a classic example of the folly of human complacency, doesn't it? Just because we feel safe doesn't mean we are safe. And that's a lesson the whole nation of Israel could have done well to learn. In the middle of the 8th century BC, period we're going to be looking at in this quarter of our family Bible school. The kingdom of David had been divided by this time into two kingdoms. The southern kingdom of Judah was ruled by King Uzziah. The larger northern part, generally called Israel, was ruled by Jeroboam II. And it's with that northern part of the kingdom that we'll be mainly concerned. In terms of political and economic prosperity, Jeroboam II was doing a very good job. He was an able general. He had secured Israel's borders and expanded her territory. Never since the days of Solomon had the nation been so affluent. And yet, like the Titanic, you see, her sense of security was misplaced. There was an iceberg in her path. The vast military might of Assyria. Slumbering innocuously still in the middle of the 8th century. But within a short space of years, she would rise up to deliver a blow to Israel so severe that the entire northern kingdom would sink without trace. And once again, the irony is that the disaster was avoidable. For there were radio operators in Israel, too, receiving warnings of the danger that lay ahead. Prophets with inspired insight into the course of history. Two of them, in fact. One is called Amos, and the other Hosea. But so calm did the ocean of international politics seem at the outset of their ministry that their prophetic alarm signals were totally ignored both by Jeroboam the king and the rest of the population. But it wasn't surprising. You see, Amos and Hosea were representatives of the old religion. They spoke in the name of Jehovah, the God of Moses. And frankly, Jehovah worship was regarded as rather passe in affluent 8th century Israel. If you really wanted to be a contemporary, an avant-garde person in Samaria, the Israelite capital in that day, then the popular thing to be, the in thing to be, was a follower of Baal. The cult of Baal was generally considered to be far more attractive than the austere and moralizing religion of Jehovah. Not least, of course, because of the sexual permissiveness that Baalism encouraged through its regiments of sacred prostitutes and its fertility rituals. Now, it doesn't take much to imagine the general attitude toward the like of Amos and Hosea in these comfortable, prosperous days before the iceberg struck. Conservative old fuddy-duddies. Why don't you move with the times? These modern religious ideas from abroad are much more sophisticated and exciting than that old-fashioned nonsense you're preaching. Thou shalt not commit adultery. What a bore. I reckon Moses invented it just to spoil people's fun. Get with it, Hosea. Tune in, Amos. These are the swinging 8th century. No more need for Bible bashers these days. That all went out with Elijah 100 years ago. Inevitably, the reaction of Amos and Hosea to this spiritual intransigence on the part of the nation has a lot in common. Both prophets were reinforced in their certainty of coming disaster by the impenitence of Israel in her moral degeneration and her idolatry. However, when we read these two books, Amos and Hosea, carefully, there is a notable difference between the message the two men brought, in spite of the close similarity of the historical context. Amos, you see, views God almost exclusively in the role of a judge. Assyria, for him, would be the instrument of God's judicial punishment upon the crimes of this unrepentantly sinful people. If you've been attending our family Bible school for some time, some of you may perhaps recall, we studied his fiery proclamations of divine retribution about 18 months ago. Hosea wouldn't have dissented from anything Amos said along those lines. Indeed, he has some quite outspoken prophecies of his own about judgment. But in his own presentation of the situation, it's rather different. In a way, it's even more poignant and emotive than Amos with his fiery warnings of retribution. For Hosea sees God not so much in the role of an avenging judge, but as a jilted lover. So constant, so central is this remarkable motif in Hosea's preaching, we've even dared to call our whole series of studies Love Story, the risk of raising the expectations of passers-by in the street, maybe a little unfairly. And our opening study in chapter 1 this morning reveals to us much of the foundation of that love story. The reason it was such a distinctive emphasis in Hosea's ministry. It encapsulates three related themes which we're going to come across again and again and again as we go through this book. Let me tell you what they are. First, the wounded lover. Verses 2 to 3. Second, the angry lover. In verses 4 to 9. And finally, the faithful lover. In verses 10 to 2, verse 1. So will you stay with me as we look at those three things this morning? First of all, God, the wounded lover. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. It doesn't matter which language you translate it into, adultery is always a word of shame. Even in our permissive 20th century, we prefer to avoid it. It carries a social stigma. But in ancient Israel, that stigma was far greater than it ever is in our day. Remember, adultery was placed by Moses on the list of capital crimes. It was regarded as an immensely serious matter, something terribly shameful. I suspect that's what lies behind that little incident many of you will recall when in John's Gospel we read the Jews brought a woman to Jesus. "Teacher," they said, "this woman was caught in the very act of adultery." And we read, when Jesus heard their words, he bent down and wrote with his finger in the dust. A lot of speculation been expended on just why he did that. But for myself, I've often wondered whether it wasn't simply that he had to turn his face away in sheer embarrassment at the salacious delight of these Jews at the woman's wantonness. I suspect for him the matter was just vulgar. They, parading it in public, hadn't appreciated the shamefulness of it. It was just an opportunity to score a debating point or two for them. I suspect it was their indelicacy that offended the sensitivity of the Son of God, maybe even causing him to blush. For adultery in God's book is a shocking and a disgusting thing, as disgraceful and as reprehensible as murder. It isn't something even God likes to talk about. All of which, you see, makes the course of action which Hosea is commanded by God to undertake in these verses so utterly astonishing. Can we really believe it? That a prophet would deliberately marry an immoral woman? Surely a minister of religion ought to go out of his way to do the very opposite. Which church would ever call as pastor a man with a prostitute for a wife? It's unthinkable. And make no mistake about it, a prostitute is what she was. The word used in verse 2 here admits of no other interpretation. Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, wasn't just an adulteress, she was a whore. And it is a pity, I think, that of all the modern translations, only the Jerusalem Bible has the guts to put it that bluntly. The Hebrew author, by contrast, refuses to mince his terms or engage in polite euphemism. He intends to shock us. And Christians down through the ages haven't failed to be shocked. Many of the early church fathers were so offended by the idea that they wanted to say it was all an allegory. Of course, Hosea didn't literally marry such a woman, they said. It's just a parable, like the prodigal son. And unfortunately, there's nothing at all in the text to suggest they're right in that. This is no mere literary device. Other more recent commentators have tried to soften the embarrassment these verses cause them by suggesting that Hosea didn't really know about his wife's immoral tendencies until after the marriage. Some even opine that it was the personal trauma of coping with her infidelity that germinated his own prophetic calling, like a man I once met who was converted, humanly speaking, as a result of the emotional conflicts resulting from his own wife's desertion. But again, a careful study of the text makes that highly improbable. For you see, verse 2 specifically states, doesn't it, that Hosea's taking of Gomer was a conscious response to his prophetic calling, not the seedbed of it. God had already begun to speak to him, we read, when it happened. Indeed, we're told he chose her in obedience to the divine command precisely because she was a prostitute, not in naive ignorance of the fact. So what are we to make of it? Now, the truth is, you see, that prophets in the Old Testament didn't only deliver verbal sermons, as preachers do today. Sometimes they turned the message that God gave them into symbolic acts, which they rehearsed before the eyes as well as the ears of their audience. Many examples of that in the Bible. And almost certainly what we have here then in Hosea's marriage is one of the most poignant and compelling examples of such prophetic histrionic. For this is no mere pantomime. This is no contrived theatrical. This is an oracle of God translated into the flesh and blood of a real life drama. Go take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness. Because when you bear in mind the license that accompanied Baal worship, adultery was all too appropriate, a metaphor for Israel's abandonment of the religion of Jehovah. The land is guilty of the vilest adultery, says God, in departing from the Lord. But it's so important to realize that God isn't just making a comment here in verse 2 on Israel's sexual immorality. What he's doing is actually portraying his own relationship to Israel as that of a deceived husband, like Hosea. In Old English, they would have called him a cuckold, a man whose wife was cheating on him. That's what you've got to be, Hosea, because that's what I am, says the Lord. Baal worship has not just rendered Israel sexually adulterous, it's rendered her spiritually adulterous too. No more emotive words could surely have been chosen to express it. Israel's idolatry was clearly not something God viewed with the detached objectivity of a disinterested spectator. It was something he felt passionately about. And why? Why, he tells us, because God is not a distant uncle to his people. God is the husband of his people. The covenant that binds God to his people isn't some loose, ineffectual political treaty. It's a marriage vow. And Israel, by her flirtatiousness with Baal, was trampling all over that marriage vow. I don't believe there is any lesson more important for us to learn from this passage this morning, or indeed perhaps from the whole book of Hosea, than this. That Christianity is not just a matter of how we feel toward God. It is a matter of how he feels toward us. When Christ says he purchased the church to be his bride, he means it with utter seriousness. We are precious to him as a wife. He is as committed to us as a husband. And so when we apostatize, when we backslide, when we fail to honor him, when we choose to put other things at the center of our lives rather than to worship him and serve him, he does not feel a mild irritation. He feels like a cuckold, a victim of spiritual adultery. Some of you who read a lot of books may be aware that historically Christian theology has often talked about the impassibility of God. God cannot suffer, have said some of the systematic theologians. Well, I really do wonder if they're right. Of course, the God of the Stoics couldn't suffer, that's true. He was an emotionally petrified deity. He felt nothing analogous to the surging passions of us human beings. Isolated in his little island of self-sufficiency, he needed nobody. And the Stoic philosophers who believed in such a God sought to copy his emotional indifference, of course. But is that the God of the Bible? I think it is not. What is the cross of Calvary if it isn't a terrifying confirmation of the agony God suffers because of our sin? See, God isn't a heavenly policeman who administers cosmic law and order with dispassionate serenity. The moral law of God is the law of his own holy character, and when we break his commandments, we hurt him personally. God isn't an academic theologian defining metaphysical truth like a textbook in the library. The doctrines of the Bible are the truths of his own character, his own nature. And when we worship idols, we hurt him personally. Sin is a slander against him. It is a slap around his face. It's not something about which God can discuss neutrally, like a surgeon clinically commenting on the presence of a cancer. Sin is something that offends him, that wounds him. And when he sees it in his people, it stings him, as a wife's adultery stings her husband. Now, this dramatic gesture Hosea was called upon to make, to marry an adulterous woman, is a plaintive cry from a God whose heart is pained by unrequited love. The wounded lover. Perhaps that ought to be an encouragement to some of us here this morning. Because maybe that sort of pain is a pain you're all too familiar with. Some of you here I know have had unhappy marriages, and I'm sure there are more of you here that I don't know personally in that situation. You felt wounded by the rejection and the deceitfulness of a partner in whom you invested immense emotional trust. And perhaps you sometimes wonder whether God really sympathizes with that particular inner agony you feel. After all, as one unhappy man said to me once, Jesus was never married, was he? How can he possibly understand what a divorce feels like? Well, the story of Hosea perhaps reassures us that he can understand. For even though, unlike Baal, he has no female consort, he knows what passion is. He knows what it means to be hurt by adultery, too. Indeed, it may be, you know, that prayerful reflection upon marital unhappiness when it comes into our lives can do for us exactly what it did for Hosea. Expand our spiritual consciousness to a degree of empathy and insight into the heart of God himself, which those fortunate enough to enjoy unspoilt marital bliss can never really know. Maybe it is only those who, like Hosea, have known a lover's pain who can really understand why the Bible speaks to us of a God who himself suffers on the cross. That's the beginning of Hosea's love story. The wounded lover. But again, those of you who have been wounded that way will know that hurt isn't the only thing you feel in that situation, is it? You feel angry, too. And so does God. The angry lover. Look at verse 4. The angry lover. Look at verse 4. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, this son Gomer has borne, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day I will break Israel's bow, a symbol of breaking her military power in the valley of Jezreel. See, one of the commonest mistakes I find in dealing pastorally with people concerns this whole issue of anger. Many people, many Christian people particularly, think anger is a sin. Anger is something they say you should always deny. So you find whenever their child expresses even the faintest hint of anger, they viciously suppress it. Anger is a violent passion, they say, and all violence is wrong. Would you be very shocked if I told you I thought that was a dangerously misleading attitude to adopt? How can anger be a sin when we read time and time and time again in the Bible that God is angry? Oh, I know there's such a thing as temper. I know all too often the wrath of man doesn't work the righteousness of God. Like everything else about us, our anger reflex has been corrupted by selfishness and sin. But that does not mean that anger is always wrong or that it ought always to be repressed. Sometimes, you know, a refusal to show anger only serves to make matters worse. Think of a wife whose husband constantly abuses her. If she goes on day in, day out, meekly accepting his abuse without protest, isn't she in danger of condoning his behavior by her passivity? Maybe if she threw a saucepan through the window or broke a few plates on the kitchen floor, maybe he might wake up to his beastliness. At the very least, it would be an honest statement of her own indignation at his behavior. See, it's not always a choice between a loving response or an angry response. Sometimes anger is a consequence of love. It's the ability to feel angry that distinguishes real love from mere sentimentality. And the same is true of God's relationship to his people. He won't stand around to let us abuse him indefinitely. He is a jilted lover. He's a wounded lover. He is an angry lover. And in Hosea's little prophetic drama, it was the christening ceremony of the children that brought that note of divine fury into the open. Three children, Gomer bears. The first was certainly Hosea's, we're told so. But many scholars question the paternity of the other two. For verse 2, you remember, speaks of children of prostitution. And since the text doesn't explicitly say that Hosea was the father of Gomer's daughter and second son, there is perhaps a case for suspecting they were illegitimate. Certainly if they were, it would add all the more irony to the names that Hosea gave them. For each of these children became a mini sermon. Every time he called for them in the street, he preached to his neighbors the anger of this loving God to whom Israel had been so unfaithful. Jezreel was the first, an innocent enough word, until you realize the historical associations that it carried with it. Jezreel for every Jew was a place of bloodshed. An entire royal house of Israel had been slaughtered there by Jehu 100 years before. Every Jew knew that that blood guilt had to be avenged eventually. Derek Kidner, in his excellent little commentary, which you might consider buying on this book of Hosea, suggests that calling his son Jezreel was a bit like a black South African calling his son Soweto, or a Lebanese Palestinian calling his son Beirut. Ever since Jehu's notorious massacre, violence had become a way of life in Israel. Well, the day of reckoning for all that bloodshed was on its way. God the angry lover would see to that. He had not forgotten Jezreel. Then came Lo Ruhamah, means unloved or unpitied. A cruel name, you might think, to give to your own daughter, since surely there is no psychologically damaging, more serious thing to do to any child than to make it feel unwanted or rejected. Now, you see, that's precisely how God felt about Israel. For her sister Judah, he still entertained some affection, he said. When the iceberg struck, he would intervene on Judah's behalf. Though dwarfed by Assyrian military might, she would survive in the lifeboats. I will show love to the house of Judah. I will save them, though not by the bow, the sword, or battle, or by horses or horsemen. But not Israel. Her apostasy had gone too far. Her offenses against the covenant had wounded him too deeply. He was the angry lover now, in no mood for reconciliation. Call her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer show love to the house of Israel. So Gomer gives birth to the third child, and to Israelite ears, the most devastating name of all, Lo-Ami, not my people. Yet it was God himself who had said to Moses, I will be your God, and they shall be my people. That's what the covenant was all about. That was the covenant formula. And yet here is God repudiating that relationship. See, we're not talking here about some domestic tiff. We're talking about an action for divorce. God, the angry lover, will not keep an unfaithful people in his household. Call him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. What a powerful warning there is for us here, isn't there? See, it is profoundly dangerous to toy with God's affections, or to presume upon God's grace. There are many aspects of God's character which are infinite, I know, but patience isn't one of them. Perhaps the problem is that we misunderstand again or underestimate the significance of that word jealousy. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. For like anger, we think of jealousy so often as a vice, don't we? That's because we confuse it with covetousness. The difference between the two words is subtle, but very important. It's one thing to desire something that belongs to somebody else. That's covetousness. That is a sin. But it is quite another thing to guard with possessive zeal something that is rightly and exclusively my own. That's jealousy. And it is not a sin. If someone steals my car, I'm angry. I'm rightly angry because I am jealous over my car. It's mine. If someone were to steal my wife, I'd be angry too, I can tell you. Because I am rightly jealous over my wife. She is mine. The Bible believes in an old-fashioned idea of marital property. A husband has property in his wife, and a wife has property in her husband. They belong to each other. For the glorification of communal ownership in our day is threatening that fundamental moral understanding of marriage. It's the fundamental flaw in communism as a philosophy, that it fails to distinguish covetousness from jealousy. God suffers no such blind spot. You shall not make graven images or worship them. Why? Because I'm a jealous God. You are my people, my bride, and I will visit my anger on you and your children and your children's children for any breach of my property rights in this matter. We dare not think of God as some sentimental weakling who will take our spiritual adultery passively. He will not. He will go to court. His patience with sinners is huge, but it is not infinite. For infinite patience is indistinguishable from moral indifference, and God will not be that. It's a very dangerous thing to trade upon his mercy. If necessary, he will disown us. If necessary, he will throw us out of the house. Nowhere in the Bible does God ever promise pardon to the obstinately impenitent. So I have to tell you this morning, if you are such, you are in serious danger. For you have wounded a profound love by your indifference to Christ. And that heavenly lover is now angry with you No matter how secure and prosperous you may feel, if you aren't right with God, you are a passenger on the Titanic. And Hosea would warn you of the disaster that lies ahead before it is too late. But that brings us to the third theme of this whole prophecy, which Hosea strikes in this first chapter, which we dare not omit when we speak about the angry lover. And that's the faithful lover. Look at verse 10. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, "You are not my people," they will be called sons of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited, and they will appoint one leader, and they will come up out of the land. For great will be the day of Jezreel. Say of your brothers, "My people," and of your sisters, "My loved ones." Now there are some, of course, who see these words as blatantly inconsistent with the sentiments that have just gone before. What is Hosea going on about, they ask? One minute it's Israel is not my people, and then they are my people once again. One moment Hosea's daughter's name is unloved, the next he signed a deed poll and she's become my loved one instead. Inevitably some commentators conclude these verses must be an insertion by some later author who wants to soften the appalling finality of Hosea's tone in verse 9. Well, frankly, I find such suggestions totally unnecessary and utterly lacking in a sensitive engagement with this author's emotion. Neither Hosea, nor God for that matter, are speaking here with the pedantic logic of some German critical scholar. This passage is born amidst passionate collision of contradictory emotion. And the text reflects that. Of course Hosea speaks of divorce. Every angry lover does. No other threat adequately expresses the intensity of a jilted lover's indignation. But God cannot allow divorce to pass from decree Nisi to decree absolute. He can't allow it precisely because of the kind of love he represents. Israel may abandon her covenant promises. He cannot abandon his. He is a faithful lover. He has to be. If he can't be a faithful lover, there is no such thing as faithful love in the universe. What Hosea, you see, is doing here is stepping back from the pain and the anger of this immediate situation in which both he and God find themselves, and perceiving the sovereign providence of which even this present unhappiness was a part. We are not to think, he's saying, that God's eternal purposes in history were all thrown overboard into the melting pot because of Israel's idolatry. Her spiritual adultery did not thwart God's plan. It didn't even take him by surprise. He knew loving sinners would mean pain and anger. But he chose to do it. Just as Hosea chose to take Gomer as his wife, knowing the unhappiness that was bound to cause. For God had a long-term plan in mind, you see. He knew the lover's pain would one day be over. He knew that that lover's anger would one day be resolved. He knew how he would finally reconcile a people to himself, in spite of all their propensity to infidelity. God demonstrates his love toward us, Paul, in that while we were sinners, enemies of God, Christ died for us. Paul tells us in that letter to the Romans that Hosea's words here passed far beyond the horizon of Old Testament history, beyond Assyrian conquest and Babylonian exile and Roman occupation. They pass on to a day when the love of God would call into his people vast millions, not only from Israel and Judah, but from every nation on the face of the globe. Those who were not my people will be called sons of the living God, he says. That was God's great plan, and nothing Israel was going to do was going to thwart it. Jezreel, yes, that's a place of bloody massacre, true. You see, it stands for something else too. Translated literally, Jezreel means God serves. Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abides alone. But if that corn of wheat die, it brings forth much fruit. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men to myself, he said. I mean, Hosea's naming of his firstborn was not just a warning of disaster. It was a promise, too, of restoration to come. His own firstborn, perhaps his only son, true son, of this woman. Albeit it would be on the other side of bloodshed and divine vengeance, but restoration would be there. Great will be the day of Jezreel. Then you'll say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved ones. And this is why, you see, perhaps unlike Amos in some respects, Hosea's prophecy is such a gracious, hopeful book. He doesn't minimize God's rage against unfaithful Israel. He can't do that. He's felt a lover's anger himself. He knows the intensity of it. But neither can he let that anger have the last word. Where sin abounded, Hosea knew that grace would much more abound. And that, you see, is our consolation this morning. That may be the consolation of this whole book for many of us in this congregation. I want to speak to some of you here who, like Israel of old, have been spitting in the face of God for a very long time. Your divine lover, but you have spurned him. Well, you know he's been speaking to you. Perhaps once upon a time in your life, like Israel, you did respond to his voice with some measure of sincerity. But right now, for one reason or another, you are rebellious and you are backsliding. Like Israel, you've departed from the Lord. Perhaps it was the force of some moral temptation that brought you here. You're alienated from God because you couldn't resist some sin that you so much wanted to indulge in. Perhaps you've let other things consume your life, your career, your studies, your sport, your politics. So these things have become idolatrous baals, usurping the affection you owe to God. Perhaps like Israel, you've become infatuated with some other more modern, sophisticated thought than old-fashioned Bible religion that they teach at Eden Chapel. Or maybe it's simple neglect that's brought you to this estrangement with him. Neglect of prayer, of Bible study, of fellowship. However it's happened, your heart is cold towards God. You're committing spiritual adultery. You've hurt God, he's angry with you, and you feel completely isolated from him. If that's true, I can say one thing with absolute certainty about you. You are a very miserable person. No one is more miserable than a backsliding Christian. At least the sinners of the world enjoy themselves for a little while, but a person who really belongs to God and forsakes him feels just like a fish out of water all the time. For God won't allow us, you see, to enjoy our sins. The spirit he's placed within us grieves over us. Guilt burns our consciences. A blush rises to our face whenever somebody tells us to pray. Spiritual dissatisfaction just gnaws at our hearts. No one is sadder or lonelier than a spiritual divorcee, believe me. But then you know that, don't you? What I want to tell you this morning is that God is a faithful lover. Well, he will chasten you. But if you are really his, he will never damn you. He may humiliate us, demolishing our pride, making us feel like the scum of the world. But it's thus he's determined to save us. Maybe we, like Gomer, have walked the streets of spiritual prostitution, careless of the suffering of our divine husband. We've added sin upon sin to the weight of agony that God has to bear for us on that cross. And now we experience the emptiness, the awful emptiness of a soul who feels forsaken by God. Well, be encouraged, for God will have you back. That's the message Hosea is going to teach us. God will have us back. I had to counsel a couple once who had passed through a period of estrangement as a result of unfaithfulness of one of them. But in a very marvellous way, God brought them back together again. Do you know what the wife said to me? She said, you know, when our marriage was breaking up, it was sheer hell. But making it up again has been like a second honeymoon. Sheer heaven. Perhaps like Israel of old, we need a second honeymoon with God. His arms are open to us. The wounded lover he may be, the angry lover he may be, the faithful lover he certainly is. Let's pray together.